Welcome back to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Cressy, and this is episode 184. I have an old friend on this podcast, a guy who has some deep roots in the baseball world, and he's seen it at the college levels and the amateur ranks as he's worked with younger players, including his own sons. And I think he has an awesome perspective on how coaching has trended over an extended period of time. He also shares some great wisdom on just finding value in unexpected places, both in the baseball world and in the business world he's in now. I think I really enjoyed this conversation because of how we reflected on how baseball development at the youth levels has really evolved over the course of time, and even talking about some strategies that I think can improve how we work with younger kids and their parents just to create better developmental situations and really grow the game as a whole. So I think this was an awesome episode, and hopefully you enjoy it as much as I did. This episode is brought to you by AG1, the most comprehensive NSF certified for sport daily nutritional supplement I've ever tried. With so many stressors in life, it can be difficult to maintain effective nutritional habits and give our bodies the nutrients they need to thrive. As a father of three young kids and a co-founder of multiple businesses in multiple states, on top of still being an avid exerciser, I know that busy schedules can really take their toll on us. Whether it's poor sleep, exercise or life stressors, environmental factors, or simply not eating enough of the right foods, we can often wind up deficient nutritionally. This is where AG1 can really help. It's a game-changing nutritional insurance policy. They simplify the logistics of getting optimal nutrition on a daily basis by giving you just one thing with all the best things. That's why I use it daily, as do several of my family members, and we recommend it to a lot of our top athletes. One scoop of AG1 contains 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients that work together to fill the nutritional gaps in your diet to support energy, focus, digestion, and recovery. And this can all happen for less than $3 per day and without taking multiple products. While most nutritional supplements come to market and stay stagnant, AG1 continues to obsessively improve this one holistic formula based on the latest research, producing over 50 improvements in the last decade alone. They invest in the most absorbable and natural source of each ingredient and go above and beyond in third-party testing to ensure their customers continue to receive the highest quality and best-tasting nutrition habit on the planet. Whether you're keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free, it'll work for you, and it contains less than 1 gram of sugar per serving. They put 75 ingredients through the rigorous NSF certification test to come up with a safe formula that's trusted by some of the world's top athletes, including many of our own at Cressy Sports Performance. Right now, AG1 is giving our listeners a special offer of 10 free travel packets with their first purchase. Just head to drinkag1.com/Cressy and claim this special offer. These travel packets are perfect for supporting your immune system, energy, and gut health while you're traveling for games, training, or simply on the go. They can be great counterbalance to the less than ideal on the road food options that are out there for a lot of our traveling baseball players. So if you want to bridge the gap between deficient and optimal and give yourself the best chance of getting nutrient diversity, head to drinkag1.com/Cressy to get 10 free travel packets with your first purchase. Again, that's drinkag1.com/Cressy, C-R-E-S-S-E-Y. You won't regret it. Today's guest has built a career around baseball and business. His professional journey began by becoming the youngest college head coach in the country at the age of 23 and taking over a struggling program at Shawnee State University. He led them to a fifth place finish at the NAIA World Series 5 years later. He used this experience developing that program to build over 35 different businesses in the fitness and sports performance industries, ranging from a franchise with over 275 locations to the largest youth fitness and sports performance certification in North America. Throughout this time, he's continued to be involved in baseball, coaching his son's teams, as well as consulting with college programs and training facilities. Today, he coaches fitness and sports performance business owners when he's not coaching travel baseball or spending time with his family. Please welcome to the show, Pat Rigsby. You can learn more about Pat and his services at patrigsby.com. Pat, this invitation is incredibly overdue, so thank you very much for joining the podcast.
Well, I am excited to be here, and as an avid fan, it's cool to be a participant.
Well, you've been like very involved, and I feel like every aspect of the baseball world. Like you've obviously played, you've coached, you've been a parent, you've consulted for baseball businesses. You've kind of seen it from all different angles. So I think we're actually in for like a cool multifaceted discussion. But maybe the place where we start is, you know, I never loved a, hey, tell us about yourself intro, but I think it is important because we should have you tell your baseball story as both a player and, you know, the ascent into the coaching ranks.
Well, the The player piece of it was pretty unspectacular. I mean, I was an okay player that probably got to be on college rosters largely because I was a catcher. Had the opportunity to actually kind of shift gears and be a student assistant towards the end of my undergrad time. And it was, it was definitely the right move for me. I think that I saw the writing on the wall as far as where my ceiling was. Now, ironically enough, I got involved in the Frontier League first on the front office side, if you will, like assistant GM and then assistant coach, and then ended out playing in the Frontier League a little bit, which was a fun kind of capstone to my playing days. But again, was a pretty sound reminder that I was butting up against the ceiling of my playing aptitude. But it was something that I was always excited to be around. Obviously, I just really loved baseball. And so I sent out a bunch of resumes as I was wrapping up undergrad, tried to find a volunteer spot, a GA spot. You know, I kind of everything fell on deaf ears. I only got a couple of replies that were just polite no's. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, the gentleman who had been the head coach at the university where I had been decided to step down. The university at that point was a NAIA program. So it was a scholarship school that wasn't very well resourced, had yet to have a winning season. And they had decided they were going to try to add football and move to Division III. So they cut scholarships, but still had this transition period. And they were going to stay competing in the NAIA with, you know, against scholarship, opponents who had scholarships. And so it wasn't exactly a job that was in great demand. And somehow I was able to get hired at the ripe old age of 23. So I was the youngest head coach in the country in a program that had no track record of success, didn't own our own facilities. And now we're going non-scholarship, playing in a scholarship division. So it didn't sound like there was a whole lot of probability of success, but I mean, you can't really turn down that opportunity when it comes along. So that was the beginning. That was kind of the inroad to me becoming a college head coach. And it was very much a whirlwind.
I've never heard these stories, despite the fact I feel like I've known you close to 20 years now. How did that go? I mean, do you walk into that just being like, oh, I guess I'll fail forward, let's see how this goes? Or did you come in with a plan, or was it walk in and just see what I got and then pivot from there?
So, you know, I think I tried to cobble together a plan. I had been an assistant there, like a student assistant, and then the top assistant, and just in that short, like 2-year window. But I didn't really, you know, I'd never really been part of a great program, didn't really have that kind of background. So I went and just started asking some more successful coaches, just kind of cold calling people. And then, you know, I was fortunate enough to have a few guys who were well-known that were high school coaches that had relationships with college coaches that had a pretty good track record, Division I coaches. And so I was able to observe, ask questions. Even the people that I cold called were just very, very receptive, almost without exception. One of the coolest things about the baseball community is it was always really, really helpful to me as a young coach. And so I put together a plan. My best friend had played Division I baseball, had played in the Reds organization. He helped me out that first year. And so we kind of used some of his experience too and pieced things together. And first season, we won 2 more games than we lost, which was the best record the school had had to that point. The second season, we were better, but it also was kind of an aha moment for me where it was just abundantly clear that there was no way that we were going to be able to be better than the people who are kind of at the top of the conference, the people that were making regionals. We weren't going to be able to be at that level doing things the way that they did them. We weren't going to have the same resources. We were in a market that wasn't going to be as attractive probably to athletes. I certainly didn't have the same level of experience those guys had. So I kind of did a pivot and said, you know what, I'm just going to blow it up and I'm going to do things differently. And if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, I'm going to at least say that I wasn't trying to be an imitation of somebody else. I was going to try to be the best version of me, I guess.
I was going to say zig when they zag, right?
Yeah.
So how did that, I mean, how did it play out? Like, you're obviously, in hindsight, you were a guy who found value where other folks missed it in the college game. Like, what were these strategies that you employed to do things differently?
So I had been somebody who really enjoyed the strength and conditioning side of things. I just enjoyed that whole kind of setting. And so
just for context, not to cut you off, what years are we talking about here? Because I think that creates it, right now it's easy to be forward thinking, yeah, and try to do things differently. A while back, it was very different.
Fall of 1997.
There you go. So
we were, you know, trap bar deadlifting and, I mean, squats with chains and all that stuff. I mean, I called Louis Sims on the phone and said like 9 words and he talked to me for 2 hours. And I mean, it was anything that I could do. We approached, you know, we approached offense very differently than everybody else that we were playing against at that time. It was still very small ball centric where we were. I was kind of the nerdy guy who was getting like a Bill James newsletter when I was in high school. So, I mean, it was on base percentage, batting my catcher leadoff. I mean, whatever we could do. And then because we didn't have scholarships, you know, I wasn't going to be able to go get 6'4" pitchers who threw hard. It was a lot of trying to get corner guys who could hit, get transfers who may not be so hung up on how much their scholarship was and maybe just thought about cost of attendance where we could compete pretty well. We were the university, Shawnee State University. It really kind of catered to first generation college students. And so I really went hard after, like, a lot of people talk about, hey, I want blue collar guys. I mean, we had a lot of really blue collar guys. And so just went and tried to find players that may not have been valued the same way at the other places we were competing against. Got a lot of guys who may have been bounce backs that went to somewhere bigger and came back and played for us. And then because I was young and single, and I mean, I was pretty relentless with recruiting. I mean, I would be on the phone constantly, and that, you know, a lot of things that I think are very commonplace today, you know, I was just kind of, to be fair, throwing some stuff against the wall and some of it stuck. And the next year we were, I think, 35-11, and we were nationally ranked and led the country in hitting and like second home runs per game. And so now you've got something to sell, right? Like, you can snowball with that. And it just kept climbing from there. My fifth year was the first year they actually had kind of thrown in the towel on the idea of going Division III. So they gave us 1.7 scholarships.
There you go.
And we finished
$20 for everybody.
yeah. Basically, that was about it. And so we finished fifth at the World Series that year. You know, and we had made like 3 regionals in a row now. And so we were, I thought, pretty good considering the resources that we had available. And, it was still pre-Twitter and a lot of that. So still a lot of the things that we were at the time, maybe a little bit more progressive with, were not commonplace. And so they still provided something of a competitive advantage.
You know, I think the thing that folks from afar might not appreciate is like, so this is 1997. Like CSP was founded in 2007, in part because we thought that baseball athletes were very underserved with strength and conditioning. And then taking it a step further, we also had a situation where basically like Moneyball was 2003, 2004, where that's when that movie came out. And you effectively were doing it, I mean, pre-Moneyball, effectively 6 years in advance. So, and this is all happening at a small school. Like, I'm curious, like you talk about being a nerd and things like that. Was there something about your own background that drew you to finding these progressive things? Like, do you think there's a lesson there for young coaches to like turn over every rock in their development? Or is it just something that kind of found you because of the circles you rolled in?
It definitely wasn't the circles I was in. I think it was because I was fortunate enough to be around some pretty good baseball players and would look to find ways to close the gap.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think I've always been relatively resourceful, and so, and had no problem cold calling people or reaching out to people or asking questions. And, you know, I think that for me has always been just kind of a default setting. If there's a problem, I think I am just a solution seeker, and I'm just going to keep turning over stones until I find something. And fortunately, you know, that stuff worked, and we had a lot of guys that bought in, and it just created a really, really good culture where, you know, I don't know that that's easy to do as a really young coach to create that and manage that with people that much younger. But I think that we just had players who liked it, they bought into it, and they kind of kept the guardrails there, and everybody who came into it really, really bought in.
I mean, you scouting and player development have to work together. I think traditionally in baseball, they've been very separate entities. And like, you obviously recruited guys that you knew you could develop. You weren't going and like bringing kids that didn't believe in lifting heavy things or, you know, weren't willing to try new stuff. You had to find growth mindset kids.
Yeah. And if I look back, the year after we went to the World Series was probably the first time that we were a little bit of a destination, and it wasn't kind of turning over rocks and finding the unrecruited guys. And we were getting a few kids who were turning down like mid-major programs that maybe weren't that strong to come to play for us. And you know, a few of them, it just wasn't a fit, right? Because they were used to being recruited. They were used to getting some attention. And we had typically done best with people who had a little bit of a chip on their shoulder.
I respect that a lot. I mean, so one of the things I'm curious about is like many of the coaches that are listening to this podcast are obviously trying to climb the coaching ladder. There's invaluable insights just with what you said, right? Find value, other people's miss it, and be open-minded doing things. But at a time in life where you were clearly crushing it, you opt to go in a different direction, right? So, you know, a lot of people would have said, I'm going to springboard this and, you know, I'm going to go and I'm going to be in the SEC or the ACC. Like that's the career destination. But I'm curious, what was your path that you chose instead? And what was the rationale for stepping away from coaching?
Well, I think on the field, things were going very well. I definitely had created some friction with at least a segment of the administration, and then the president that was at the university that was very supportive and eager to kind of escalate the support for the program left. I had a vice president that I was under, and he wasn't quite as much of a baseball enthusiast. And to be fair, I in hindsight, I clearly fed into that because I think that I would go directly to the president if I had a question. I wasn't great with the chain of command thing. And so it became an untenable situation working there. And then I had applied for jobs as you know, a paid assistant at the Division I level. I'd applied for a few jobs, probably a rung up the ladder from where we were. And, you know, I didn't really get any bites. And what I recognized was that, you know, being in an NAI program and not having an extensive network, and even if I knew people where I'd gone and worked camps and stuff, I probably wasn't going to be the person that was at the top of their recommendation list, because they had people that had played there, their assistants. And it, you know, it just seemed like I was butting up against, you know, a little bit of a ceiling. And I don't know that at the time, because we had done well enough, I don't know that I was humble enough to say, hey, I'm going to start back down at the bottom and be a volunteer somewhere. Because those, I got a couple really good volunteer opportunities and I just wasn't eager to do it. And I think in truth, it was humility, right? Like I needed to say, look, I need to go be an apprentice. I need to go do this. And maybe because of the track record I have, I can ascend a little faster, but still this is part of the deal. So, you know, so I knew I wanted to control my own destiny more. I knew I wanted to, if I was going to continue to coach, be in an environment where the resources weren't a deterrent, where we at least were, you know, top half the conference, wherever we're going to be. And ironically enough, I didn't really get offered what I considered good jobs till after I had owned a business. Yeah. So I think, you know, the thing that I would tell any young coach now is, you know, be okay with, you know, stepping back and having humility and paying your dues and connecting. Because I mean, I think that you may in the moment see it as like a step backwards, but man, it opens so many doors going forward. And you know, I think that sometimes that's hard for people. I know it was hard for me as somebody who had a little bit of success. But if I wanted to continue coaching, it was clearly the right path. And I don't know that I was ready to do that at the time. And that probably was a bottleneck, but it also led me to something that I think has worked out much better, because I did want to control, you know, my own destiny, or maybe the way that I thought of it was like, hey, if we're better, you know, the opportunities are better, the resources are better. And so, you know, I think it's worked well, but that's definitely the advice I'd give somebody.
Absolutely. You know, I'm curious, like, you know, maybe the best play for like continuing towards the latter half of the interview is like, talk about what that meant. Like you went off, you started your own business, obviously made you more appealing in a different way to you know, other opportunities, but what was the initial transition and how has it led to where you're at today?
So, you know, I went and actually ran a baseball facility, more of a skill development. We added in a strength and conditioning piece, ran camps, lessons. And that was kind of my foray into the business world. It was like, well, I don't really want to go back and get a doctorate or something like that, or start over and get an MBA. I'm like, so I'm just going to get some practical experience. And, you know, I did that for a little bit, worked in a personal training business briefly. I'd kind of set a deadline in my own, you know, in my own mind, or self-imposed deadline of saying, okay, I'm going to own a business by, I had said, you know, by the end of 2004, and I finished coaching in 2002. So a pretty short window, but, you know, I got an opportunity to start a personal training business in conjunction with a health club. I had to move to a town, kind of sight unseen. I'd never been there before. Didn't know anybody. And frankly, it went well and it grew very quickly. I mean, we went from zero to over 400 clients in 18 months. And this was one-on-one training in a town in the middle of Kentucky. So not exactly what we'd consider like a hotbed for fitness. But you know, it was a lot of the a lot of the stuff that I had learned as a baseball coach. I mean, the recruiting is selling, right? And frankly, recruiting, I think, is smart selling because it's actually a realistic sales cycle, not maybe the sales cycle people want to have where it's, oh, somebody's aware of who we are and they instantly hand us a credit card, right? So there, you know, there was that. There was the idea of team building and, you know, hiring and install. I mean, I had a playbook as a baseball coach. So instantly it was, you know, hey, we're going to put together our own operating manual. And so I took all the things that I had had some success with and put them in place there. The first location went really well. You know, I had a couple of business partners, opened a second location. It was kind of a hybrid of a health club and a personal training business that grew very quickly. And before you know it, you know, some people are like, hey, what are you doing over there? Can you give us some insight? Can you give us some advice? And it started to open the door to, hey, maybe there's some other opportunities to have an impact here.
Absolutely. You always do a good job in your business consulting in the fitness space and really outside of it. I know you've done stuff even above and beyond for other companies that aren't even necessarily in this realm. You do a lot of talking about analogies. You know, you relate a lot of things back to baseball. And we've, you know, hinted at the playbook just there. Like, what aspects of your baseball journey made for such great teaching tools when you were working across other industries?
You know, I know I mentioned this just in passing before we started recording, but it's like there's never a day in my business life that I don't draw from something from my coaching career, from even time as a player, whether it's being adaptable and problem solving or appreciating the relationship side of things and seeing people as more than transactional. I think, you know, as a college baseball coach, you learn very quickly that, you know, somebody breaks up with their girlfriend or somebody has a final exam coming up, the off the field stuff impacts the on the field stuff. And so I think that's helped me a great deal in understanding not just the business owners I coach, but the clients that they have and helping them understand that. You know, I mentioned the sales cycle, the recruiting piece of things, the importance of culture and how it can really drive something forward or really kind of undermine the potential that you have. And, you know, I think that I've always kind of been a bootstrapped business person, and starting off at a program where we had, you know, the worst resources of the people that we competed against, it just gave me an appreciation for being resourceful, for being adaptable, for being creative, that, you know, I really am grateful for to this day. And maybe the last thing I'd say is there's not a day. Well, there's probably not two consecutive days that have gone by in the past 20 years that I haven't had at least a text or some sort of correspondence with somebody who played or coached with me. Awesome. And that's a long window of time, but it's helped me here understand that, you know, the relationships drive a lot of things forward. And that's, you know, that's also why we do a lot of this. And you know, I think sometimes it's easy as a business person to become kind of transactional. And I think, in hindsight, all the stuff from that first leg of my journey that I appreciate most are the relationships. So it's helped me avoid ever falling into that trap in business.
You know, it's funny. I never realized you were a catcher. You know, after all these years of working together on a variety of projects and just crossing paths and all that, like, you know, I talk a lot about it. It seems like the best major league managers were catchers. and utility players. Like they always understand this concept of servant leadership. It's, you know, catchers, they take BP last, right? They've been there. They've been doing receiving. They've been doing game prep. They've been serving the pitchers all along. Like, do you think that that actually carried forward a lot into your coaching journey and obviously into the consulting work you do now?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I had always heard that, read that. And if I look back, a lot of the people that influenced me were catchers as well. So I think there's something to it. I think there's something to be said for being willing to sacrifice for yourself a little bit, but then also some of the, hey, I'm the one who sees the entire field. I'm the one who, you know, has to kind of move the pieces around. And you know, I'm the gatekeeper of the only thing that goes on the scoreboard. So, you know, I've always, even if I didn't believe it wholeheartedly, I've always kind of leaned into it since I was a catcher.
I love that.
We interrupt this podcast with a quick reminder that this episode is brought to you by AG1. It's an NSF certified all-in-one superfood supplement that features 75 whole food sourced ingredients designed to support your body's nutritional needs. I use this product daily myself, and a ton of our athletes do as well. Head to drinkag1.com/Cressy and claim my special offer of 10 free travel packets with your first purchase. AG1 gives you peace of mind that you're covering all your nutritional bases. Again, that's drinkag1.com/Cressy, C-R-E-S-S-E-Y, and you'll get that special offer.
All right, so shifting gears, as I implied, years after stepping away from organized coaching, you are back in it as dad/coach. And I'm actually genuinely fascinated about this because, you know, your young son, Alex, is on the cusp of being one of those kids that you would have recruited 20 plus years ago. And I'm curious now that you're involved, he's old, just so I know.
He's 13.
13. Yeah. So you're on the cusp of it. So talking about youth baseball now, what's changed for the good and the bad since, I mean, really the late 90s, early 2000s.
So, and to, you know, to be fully transparent, I was around this with my stepson, who's now senior in college, Tyler. So I've not, you know, it's not just been something that blindsided me, but it's definitely accelerated a lot, right? I would say that, you know, sometimes it gets a little bit of a bad rap where people almost act like everything's bad, but it's not. I mean, I think that people have access to more good coaching and insight and information than they ever had. I mean, frankly, a lot of the things that I think were advantages for me as a coach wouldn't be advantages anymore because, you know, it's like you're one tweet away from, you know, great insight. I mean, you share more great information for free through YouTube videos or podcasts than a guy like me would have ever been able to access paid or any other way during my coaching time. So the way that so much good information, so much good coaching is readily available to people, I think is pretty awesome. I think that the ability for people to be seen, to be connected. I mean, I know people who've gotten scholarships. I even know one guy that got signed by just posting a video on Twitter. So, I mean, that's stuff that I don't take for granted. I think it's great that there's some of that. I think the things that I may not be so fond of are the fact that it feels very short-sighted. You know, I know some of our early collaborative work was in the world of long-term athletic development. And I don't think there's a lot of that really gets to the forefront in youth baseball, youth sports. And, you know, and all the incentives for the adults are in being short-sighted. I mean, running tournaments every weekend, everything's the World Series, everything's the state championship. And, you know, so people want to win immediately. They want some sort of immediate gratification. I mean, their rankings for 7U teams and all that silliness. And you know, so I think that not understanding that, yeah, there are milestones along the way. I mean, it's I truly believe that, I mean, if you want people to stick, they have to have some success, right? Like people don't continue to do things indefinitely that make them miserable. But, you know, the whole goal, I think, of, you know, 10U travel baseball should be to help develop a kid and to create a positive enough experience they want to play at 11U. Yep. And I think that, yeah, I mean, having some success plays into it, because if you go 0-35, you're probably not having fun and don't want to come back. But yeah, I think that there's just that kind of short-sighted nature. And I think that because it's become so well monetized, there's no real turning back from it very easily. But yeah, I mean, that's probably my opinion in a nutshell.
I think it's spot on. And I worry too. You know, I think we've kind of seen in the like the NFL side of things with like the concussion stuff and parents pulling back on participation, just out of fears for that. Like, I do worry if we actually get to the point where there is a level of correction purely from a sports medicine standpoint, when we're seeing 12-year-olds having Tommy John. That should not happen. Like, sports medicine is not able to keep up with how quickly injuries are pacing. So I do worry that as the game becomes increasingly monetized, do we actually have a little bit of like a sports medicine crisis that reduces participation? Because I think we do know that like Little League kids don't stick around well. It's a slower moving sport, right? They can go play lacrosse. They can go play another sport that just doesn't have off switches. And so I think baseball leaves itself a little bit vulnerable. That's why I love some of the rule changes, honestly, keeping people more engaged in the game, more action and all that stuff. Maybe a little bit of like a pivot is, you know, you obviously found value in unexpected places as a coach back then. Now coaching, you know, younger kids, are you going against the grain in different ways? Like, we talked about something in terms of like roster management and all that. Like, that I thought was a fascinating thing that we spoke probably a couple of weeks ago about.
So, you know, I think so. I think that my feelings towards the way that we've done things are that, you know, I want people to have a very positive experience now, but I want them to be on the trajectory to be successful in high school. I think that my job is to kind of be the steward of their baseball journey from, you know, we've had the same team at 12U that we'll have at 13U, which I have found that's very rare, apparently, because, you know, everybody wants to aggregate the biggest, the strongest, whatever. And we just kept the same roster. And the idea was, hey, let's develop these guys and prepare them to hand them off to whatever's coming next in high school, and hopefully set them up so that they make a good first impression whenever they're at a high school tryout or they're doing things what I would, you know, I loosely define as the right way when they get there. But I know that I spend more time, and so I guess collectively we spend more time talking about being a great teammate. I think that a lot of the work is become very individualized, right? I mean, I had kids even back when my now 22-year-old was 13, 14. I had parents saying, well, should he go to his lesson or should he come to practice? And I said, well, you know, we're practicing the stuff we're going to do in like the game, right? But, you know, so we spend a lot of time being a great teammate, because I think that, you know, that has a lot of carryover to life, right? I mean, baseball, I think, is a very unique sport in that it's this wonderful blend of, you know, having to be a great teammate, but you're not the only person. Like, it's about you, but it's not only. I mean, there are going to be instances as a batter, as a pitcher, when the ball's hit to you where the spotlight's on you and you've got to play your part. But it isn't like football or basketball where we can kind of force more of the burden of scoring on you or something like that. And so I think that reminding them, hey, your job's to play your role whenever you're not at the plate, whenever you're, you know, in the dugout and not on the field on defense. You know, we try to play everybody at least three different positions, because I think that being versatile makes you more valuable pretty much anywhere, baseball or not. I think that I probably communicate more heavily with the parents than most anybody else that I know, because I mean, I've been some places they probably haven't when it comes to this stuff.
Communication as in be like parent, not volunteer assistant coach with, or is that, how is that like a relationship defined?
Well, I mean, you know how much I write. So I do a memo every week, multiple times per week, talking about everything from long-term athletic development to handling adversity to what your expectations should be to what being a great baseball parent looks like. And to their credit, I had more fun last season than I've ever had in 32 years of coaching baseball. But to their credit, they took it and ran with it. And I think that, you know, we had one of those unique teams too, where they, I think the kids really liked the idea of being a great teammate. There weren't cliques, wasn't any of that. And, you know, and I think that as a coach, you're always trying to instill those types of things. It doesn't mean that it always takes, but, you know, between trying to focus on development and also learning to enjoy process focused stuff, which sometimes is challenging in youth baseball, where everything seems to revolve around tournaments. Yeah. Understanding that the older you get, the higher percentage of your time is going to be spent outside of actual games if you want to be successful. So trying to get them to really enjoy that, appreciate that. I'd say that sort of thing. The only other thing that I would say that maybe we do a little bit differently, we do mindfulness work. We do breathing stuff. I mean, I have guest speakers come on Zoom. I've had everybody from college coaches to Olympians come on and talk about dealing with adversity or managing expectations or whatever else. So trying to just expose them to people other than me.
I love that idea. And, you know, it's funny. My next question was, what's wrong with youth baseball and how do we fix it? And I feel like you kind of answered it on the front end, but you led me to maybe a better way of asking that question is, do you think the avenue to fixing it is via the parents? Because ultimately, like, the problem is the monetization, right? And the increased competing demands for a kid's attention. At the end of the day, the parents are the ones that define where the money goes, where the kid travels, all that stuff. And like, I think you just outlined a very cool developmental plan of like, it's a curriculum for parents, right? It's a curriculum for kids, but just as importantly, they have to agree to it. You know what I mean? Because if you give this kid an amazing message and you talk about the long-term path, but then he boots a ground ball and then, you know, mom and dad yell at him in the car on the ride home, it defeats the entire purpose of what you're trying to achieve. So like, do you think that that's actually an avenue? Like, do we need to do better parent education across the board in the industry as a way to basically say, like, just don't write the checks, you know, like when this isn't the right fit?
That, you know, 100% first. And I would say that I went into this fully understanding that they don't know what they don't know. It's not their fault. And there are so many people kind of steering them otherwise or setting up expectations otherwise that they kind of just comply, thinking in some cases they don't have any alternative. And it's not just that. I mean, I see it with gymnastics. I see it with volleyball or cheer or whatever. I mean, it's all sorts of sports that take that kind of mentality. And so, yeah, I think that educating the parents and giving them other options is really it. I mean, as long as the financial incentives are all towards being short-sighted and the parents don't feel like they know any better or have other avenues, there's no reversing course. But I mean, I've even seen, to give you an idea that, yeah, there is maybe a better path forward. I know that when we stopped having middle schoolers commit to Division I programs, it changed a little bit of the way that people felt like they needed to operate when they were in this 13, 14 year old range. Like, oh, we've got to go to Lake Point and be seen. I'm like, man, these kids have never even stepped foot in a high school, let alone, you know, decide where they're going to college. And so there are ways that we can enact some change. And I don't know that necessarily means that, oh, we're going back to rec leagues and sandlot baseball, because I mean, things evolve, right? Like, things always are going to continue to evolve, but we can definitely create a scenario where, you know, the coaches at my level now are focused on handing off a more well-prepared kid to a high school coach, and high school coach is handing off a more well-prepared kid to a college coach.
You know, the thing that I think scares me the most about what we were just talking about is the most vulnerable players are the best players, right? Yeah. And you think about, like, you or I, you know, we've had kids, like, changing a diaper is changing a diaper. And if you don't know how to change a diaper or how to swaddle a baby, you have 30 friends that have all had kids in the last year and a half. Like, you can just go ask them. You can ask a nurse for advice. Like, you can figure out how to keep a child alive, right? When you get a really good 13-year-old baseball player, especially if that kid's the best player in the history of the town, which is like what we deal with a lot on our professional guys, they get pulled in so many different directions. You know, everyone has a way to monetize them. Every scout wants them to play on their scout team. You know, every showcase guy wants to basically put them out there so that it looks better. Every travel ball program, even if the kid doesn't pay, they want to put them on their roster. I've seen kids just get offered just to, like, wear their jersey and sit in the dugout and not even play for them. They get pulled in so many different directions. And that's the hard part about this, is the advice is very different for that kind of kid versus the kid that, you know, is like the ninth guy on the roster who's bouncing around and filling in for whoever couldn't make practice or whatever it is. So, you know, if for the parents that are out there, like, it's very, very important to almost realize that if you have a kid who's very, very talented, you do have to kind of play by a different set of rules. And it's totally okay to say no to people. You can't be everything to everybody. And I just can't overstate how important that is. You know, looking back, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. I know you spoke to kind of like the humility as you transitioned away from the college ranks. What are some things that maybe you would have done differently along your coaching path that in hindsight, you know, makes sense to you now?
Well, from a coaching standpoint, I think that being okay with maybe taking a step back and saying, okay, I'm happy to be a volunteer, and learn, because there's so much to learn that I don't know now, let alone then. I think that would have been the first thing. I think when I got into the business world, maybe pursuing doing more work in baseball, because clearly I love doing the work that I've done. And you had mentioned it, you know, I've had the good fortune to, you know, I've consulted with people like Dallas Baptist. I've had some, you know, some really good people in the private sector side lean on me for some consulting or coaching, but it's kind of always been almost by referral or something like that. And I've never really pursued it. Just maybe when I got into this, it wasn't really a full blown industry the way that it is now. And so I built up a bit of a marketing audience in the fitness side of things. So I think that as baseball started to the private sector side started to mature, maybe doing more with that to create more opportunities there. But, you know, I think that otherwise, yeah, I mean, you can always look at different things that may not have gone the way you wanted or whatever else. But I mean, I'm pretty happy with where I've ended up now, and it's all part of the path, right?
It worked out very well. All right. So all this has been fantastic. We always rock a lightning round at the end. I'm sure you're familiar with this. I know you are a voracious reader. Not only that, an amazing content creator. Anybody listening to this needs to sign up for your newsletter because the lessons aren't just business related. They're very life oriented as well. But what's a must read book for any athlete, regardless of age?
Grit.
Good one. Bonus points for one that has less than beyond the baseball people is what I'm going to say. And it absolutely does. So definitely a solid choice. What advice would you give to a college senior who's going through their last season of baseball? In other words, what lessons can he learn in these final months that will carry to the rest of his career, whether it's in baseball or any other industry?
You know, there are a couple that come to mind. First is enjoy the moment, because if I look back, you know, one other thing that I'd probably fix that I didn't do well is I didn't really appreciate my time coaching college baseball. It was very much winning was a relief and learning was, and losing was just a big stressor, right? And I would say enjoy the moment, enjoy practices, enjoy teammates, enjoy soaking up stuff from coaches, observe how they coach you, take lessons, because I mean, it like you are in a classroom. So you have all these opportunities to continue to learn. A lot of times, you know, you'll see people towards the end of their journey start to tune some of that out a little bit and let, you know, and other than focusing on playing the games and their own performance. So really, you know, appreciate that. Be where your feet are. Don't continually kind of look down the line and say, well, hey, is pro ball going to be an option for me or whatever else? I mean, be present. But then the next thing I would say is just build relationships like crazy. I mean, if I look back in my journey, everything's been about relationships, everything. I mean, every door that's been opened, every, the reason I still am doing what I'm doing. I mean, I have some clients I've had since like 2006, and it's all just being a relationship person. So yeah, I would say those are the things that really stand out to me.
I love that. The relationship stuff is huge. And I feel like you're a guy who's just delivered value to a lot of different people without ever asking anything in return. I'm sure more kind of times than not, it winds up being a relationship that works for you business-wise in the back end, but there's never an expectation that it takes place like that. As a dad / coach, when you and Alex are watching baseball, who are the guys that you want him to watch and why? Who do you encourage him to observe?
So my whole household are big Joey Votto fans. So it's kind of sad coming to the end of the line here. We're kind of coming up on it with him, but just everything from, you know, his approach to just the way that he's so consistent with everything. I think that was one. Alex is a left-handed pitcher, among other things. So he's always kind of gravitated to Clayton Kershaw and some of those same characteristics there, I think. And then I'll give you another one that's completely, I'm sure nobody else has ever given this type of answer before, is Billy Hamilton. So we were on the field at a Reds game, actually to meet up with Joey Votto, and Billy just took Alex under his wing and played catch with him, gave him his bat, gave him everything else. And so I think he played a lot, like paid a lot of attention to Billy Hamilton from that point forward. And it was like, look, this is how you treat people. If you want people to be a fan, to be an advocate for you, treat people like that. And I don't care if it's business or not, you know, I mean, they're going to root for you from this day forward.
That's very cool. That three really good choices. Votto just has a joy to the game, kind of like a true Renaissance man. It looks like he's just always ecstatic to be there. Doesn't take playing in the big leagues for granted. I always have enjoyed that about him. Maybe last but not least, what's next for Pat Rigsby, both with baseball and then off the field as well?
So with baseball, I will continue to coach this year. And then, you know, through, I had kind of done, I'd done this with my older one, Tyler, coached up until high school. And then we'll see. I mean, I don't know that I'll know what to do if I don't have a season of coaching, but that's kind of the point that I've committed to. And then we'll go from there coaching wise. And either way, I'll be a fan. And I think that's been one of the great things is that kind of shared experience with, you know, my older one, Tyler, now is still, you know, he's 22 and not involved in baseball. And it's still very much a common bond, a shared thing that we'll talk about, text about, go to games and enjoy. So, you know, being able to kind of have this time with Alex is a lot of fun for me. So really being present in that. Professionally, you know, I'm really enjoying the coaching consulting that I'm doing. I have to decide whether I want to write an updated edition of a book or a brand new book. I'm kind of torn between. And then, you know, I do some advising and investing in a few different things. And then I have actually, as I had alluded to, started to dabble a little bit more in the baseball side of stuff, maybe not proactively marketing to grow the baseball related side of my business, but maybe just spending more time connecting with people, talking, seeing if I can add value places.
Absolutely. And you have a very versatile skill set. So I feel like you can add value in a lot of different places. So it'll be cool to follow up on it. Where can folks find out more about you? What's the best place to check you out?
PatRigsby.com is probably the easiest. You know, I'm on all most of the social stuff. I'm not very good at Instagram, but Twitter and Facebook and that sort of thing. Or if anybody has any questions of me or just wants to be added to the newsletter list you alluded to, just shoot me an email at pat@patrigsby.com and I'll be happy to add you.
Amazing. Like I said, this was long overdue, but I actually enjoyed it a lot. And cool knowing a guy for 20 years and then doing a podcast and learning some more odds and ends that I hadn't been aware of in our conversation. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. We really appreciate you carving out some time in your schedule to listen, not just to this episode, but also to some of the episodes from our archives. If you enjoy what you heard, we'd love it if you'd share it with friends, colleagues, and teammates, as well as leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks again for your time.